And now we'll hear Billy's story.
Everyone loves a good spooky story. Want to hear something really scary?
Readers, welcome to the special Halloween edition of the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, ready to introduce you to the zombie apocalypse. Vampires. The undead. Chilling cast of characters. Fantasy. Is this another presidential nominee debate? Oh no, it's a totally ghoulish lineup of Halloween horrors. What fun! Now here's a special treat, no trick. Rick Riordan is our guest today, stopping by to introduce us to Magnus Chase, a new fantasy series young readers will devour as eagerly as the Snickers, Milky Ways, and M&Ms that'll soon be coming their way. So, settle into your favorite haunts as we turn now to page one of the book report. Fall of Night, Jonathan Mayberry's nail-biting sequel to Dead of Night, begins on a calamitous chase for a madman and the missing scientist who gave him a new unlife. Stebbins Little School is full of bodies. Children are sobbing as panicked teachers and neighbors beat down their family members outside the school, or the things that used to be their family members. Officers Fox and Hammond, along with journalist Billy Trout, are calling it the beginning of the end. This is the zombie apocalypse. An insane escaped serial killer is infecting Stebbins County with a deadly virus, and now the whole world is watching. The president and the National Guard are ready to nuke Stebbins off the map and cut their losses. But the infection is spreading, and fast. Worse, the scientist who created the virus is missing. It's a numbers game as the body count rises. Fox has to contain the infected and evacuate the living before it's too late. William Dufresne performs the tale.
Confirmed, said the same voice. Zero movement. Zetter heard several of the officers let out deep sighs. He reached for a microphone and gave a string of orders for his people to expand the ground search using the modified Desert Patrol vehicles. Lines of these dune buggy-like two-man vehicles vanished into the surrounding woods and neighborhoods, going where the heavier and clumsier Humvees couldn't. Then Zetter sat back and let out his own sigh. He got to his feet and turned to the gathered officers, all of whom fell silent.
"This is a tragic and terrible day in American history," he said. "We've all been asked to make hard decisions and to carry them out with professionalism and efficiency."
The officers nodded.
"You're all aware of the political delicacy of what has happened today."
More nods, but now they were careful. There were three huge elephants in the room with them, and nobody wanted to talk about any of them except the infection. That was safe ground because it was why they were there. The president and the governor of Pennsylvania had mobilized the Guard to stop the spread of an old Cold War bioweapon that had been released accidentally by a former Soviet scientist. That was, by strict military parlance, a clusterfuck. And the pathogen's virulence was such that it spread throughout the town, infecting virtually everyone, killing them. And then, in a twist of mad science that even Zetter found hard to accept, it brought the dead back as aggressive disease vectors. The risen dead, driven by the genetically engineered parasites that made up the substance of the pathogen, attacked like sharks, mindless, endlessly hungry, and vicious. That resulted in the second elephant in the room, the one each of them knew would haunt their lives and taint the military here on the ground and the administration in Washington, acting under orders to sterilize the town in order to stop the spread of the infection. Zetter's command predecessor, Lieutenant Colonel Macklin Dietrich, had ordered the town's emergency shelter, the Stebbins Little School, to be destroyed. It was filled with people, many of whom were infected. Every officer understood the necessity for that kill order. Most of them even agreed with it. However, a reporter, Billy Trout, from Regional Satellite News, was inside the school. Inside, but connected to the outside world via a live news feed. As the gunships opened up on the building, Trout made an impassioned plea to the world to save the uninfected children. The plea hit every single news service. The media and public outcry was immediate and massive. Massive. And that directly led to the ugliest part of this, at least for the officers in that command center. The reporter's plea was broadcast to the troops outside the building via the school's public address system. The result? One by one, the soldiers at the fence stood up and refused to follow orders. They would not kill the children. It was mutiny, and one officer, a young lieutenant, tried to nip it in the bud, but he was overwhelmed and eventually outranked as a more senior officer, Captain Rice, went to stand with the mutineers. The president had immediately ordered General Zetter to relieve Dietrich of his post and assume overall command of the situation. Every officer there knew that it was unfair to put the blame on Dietrich, just as it was unfair that the public and the media would demonize them for their actions in Stebbins County. Actions that, had they not been taken, would have opened the door to a massive and perhaps unstoppable pandemic.
We've just heard Fall of Night by Jonathan Mayberry. Rick Riordan hails from Texas and comes from a long line of teachers. So it wasn't much of a surprise when Rick decided to follow the family profession. After graduating from the University of Texas with a double major in English and history, Rick began teaching middle school. He and his wife moved to San Francisco, where he continued to teach. It was there he began writing mystery novels for adults. His first book, Big Red Tequila, was published in 1997 and became book one in an award-winning series. When Rick's son asked him for a new bedtime story, Rick began The Adventures of Percy Jackson, a boy who was half human and half God, living in modern-day America. That story became The Lightning Thief, the first of Rick's best-selling Percy Jackson and the Olympian series. Today we'll speak with Rick about his new title, Magnus Chase and the Gods of Asgard, Book 1 in the Sword of Summer series. Welcome, Rick. It's great to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thanks, Elaine. Good to be here.
You have to love an author who kills off his main character on page one. To quote you, my name is Magnus Chase. I'm 16 years old. This is the story of how my life went downhill after I got myself killed.
Yes, it's not much of a spoiler to say that Magnus Chase does die fairly early in this book.
Well, introduce us to Magnus.
Well, Magnus is a 16-year-old homeless boy who is living on the streets of Boston. He thinks his life is already pretty hard, but then he just happens to die heroically with a sword in his hand. And if you know Norse mythology, you know that according to the Vikings, that means you're going to wake up in Valhalla, the Viking paradise. That's exactly what happens, even though it's 21st century America. Magnus finds out he's now one of Odin's warriors, and his life gets really complicated very quickly.
So what age reader is the Magnus series aimed at?
You know, it's interesting. I always target the books toward the age group I know best, which is the middle grades, say ages 9 to 14. I was a teacher for many years, and that's the age I taught. However, I hear all the time from older readers, adults, teenagers, college kids, that have picked up the books or stayed with the books and loved them. And that's great, too. I think a good story should be entertaining no matter what your age.
Why do you believe kids today respond so well to mythology?
There is something about mythology that has kept it relevant for all these thousands of years. I think the elements of good storytelling really began with the myths. You have heroes and villains. You have wonderful dilemmas. You have magical powers. You have romance. You have revenge. I mean, basically all the things that humans care about and are interested in are present in those old stories, which is why we still tell them today.
What's it been like for you switching from ancient Greek to Norse mythology?
Oh, I've loved Norse mythology since I was a child. It really was my first love in terms of mythologies. I grew up reading the Thor comic books, which, granted, aren't really all that accurate with mythology. But my eighth grade English teacher gave me a book of Norse myths, introduced me to the Lord of the Rings, and I've been hooked ever since. In terms of writing about them, it's something I've wanted to do pretty much since I knew I was going to be a writer. One of the challenges, though, is that we don't have as much source material. The Vikings weren't big on writing things down. So a lot of our sources are incomplete, and we have to do a lot of guesswork about what these gods were like.
Tell us about the gods of Asgard, Thor, Loki, and Odin.
Absolutely, yes. Those are the big three that, you know, if you've heard of any of them, you've probably heard of those three. The Viking gods tend to be much more warlike than the Greek counterparts because, you know, the Vikings were raiders. They had a very warlike culture. But at the same time, the Viking gods are a lot more approachable. They're a lot closer to the common man. You can't really imagine Apollo just sort of, you know, going into Starbucks and sitting down with you and chatting over a latte. You know, but Thor, yeah, absolutely. I don't know that he'd order a latte. He'd probably order a foaming mead, but still, he was a man of the people. You could really kind of hang out with him.
What's an Inherjar?
Right. The Inherjar are, you know, excuse my Norwegian, which I do not speak, but they are the once warriors, Odin's chosen. If you die and go to Valhalla, you are reborn in his paradise there, and you basically hang out with Odin and fight each other and kill each other all day long, but not to worry, you'll wake up as good as new in time for dinner. And that, as far as the Vikings were concerned, that was paradise. But the catch is that eventually you'll have to fight in the final battle in Ragnarok. And unfortunately for the Norse gods, they know the future, and they are doomed to lose.
Can you describe the nine worlds?
Yeah, the Vikings had this really interesting idea that there's not just one world, but there are nine layers of worlds. And they're all connected by this sort of celestial Yggdrasil, which is the world tree. And the way I envision it, you can sort of climb the world tree and go from world to world. So you have Midgard, which is Middle Earth to the Tolkien fans and Earth to us. We're surrounded by Jotunheim, which is the world of the giants. They usually picture them as big mountains on the periphery of the world. Asgard, the world of the gods. Vanaheim, the world of the other gods, the Vanir, the nature gods, and it just goes on and on. You've got the elves' world, the dwarves' world, fire world, ice world. I mean, you name it, there's a world for everything. The only one that's not there is Disney World.
We're speaking with Rick Riordan on The Book Report. Okay, you write that the Norse explored North America and built settlements 500 years before Columbus. Where were those settlements?
Well, we don't know exactly how far the Vikings made it in real life. We know that they made it to what is now Canada. They have found remains, artifacts of settlements up in Newfoundland. We know, of course, that they had settlements that were permanent in Greenland. And there's been speculation about whether they ever made it as far south as Boston. There have been some proponents of that theory. In fact, there's a statue of Leif Erikson on the Commonwealth Mall in Boston. But we don't know. I just kind of took that and ran with it, that this is probably as far as they could have gotten. So I'm just going to sort of say, sure, why not? This is where they ended up.
All right. As a writer, can you tell us about your fifth period after lunch test?
Yep, you bet. Well, this is from my middle school teaching days. And basically, whenever I write a book, I imagine reading it aloud to my own students fifth period after lunch. That is a pretty tough litmus test. If you can keep the students' attention, not just the A-plus students in the front row, but every student in the class, even the reluctant ones, if you can keep their attention fifth period after lunch, you really have something going. And that's what I try to do. I try to reach all the readers.
How do you juggle your different series? Do you work on more than one book at a time?
Typically not. I typically stagger work on them. It takes about a year to write a book from start to finish. Now, at the beginning of that, some of that is just letting the ideas percolate, doing my research, taking down notes, doing ideas. And I can do that while I'm writing another project. But once I start in, the actual writing is a good 6 months of solid work on just that one project.
Can you recommend a book on Norse mythology that's appropriate for this age reader?
The best one out there right now is Dalaire's. They are, you know, it's an older book, obviously, like Dalaire's Greek myths, but the Dalaire's also did several really good books on Norse mythology, and their main compendium is still in print, still available, and it's wonderful. It's very well illustrated.
Tell us about your music.
My music, you know, I started as a guitar player in high school, and for a while there, I thought I would be, you know, a rock star. I had the long hair. I wrote songs. And then, you know, that didn't work out, and I think the world is probably a better place because it didn't work out. But I did learn a lot about storytelling, and I got an appreciation for how hard it is to break into the arts. So I think some of that transferred over, and certainly the showmanship of being on stage transferred over when I became a teacher and later a writer.
Any final thoughts about Magnus?
Magnus is probably one of my favorite characters. He is a lot grittier, a lot edgier than Percy Jackson, for instance. But he is probably the character that's closest to my own voice. So I'm anxious to share him with readers and see what you guys think.
And are you already at work on book two in the series?
I am. Book two, The Hammer of Thor, will be out next fall.
All right. Rick, thanks so much for stopping by. The book was so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you, Elaine.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now let's listen to a sample of The Sword of Summer, performed by Christopher Gwitek.
I packed my stuff, which took about 3 seconds. The sleeping bag rolled up tight and fit in my backpack with my toothbrush and a change of socks and underwear. Except for the clothes on my back, that's all I owned. With the backpack over my shoulder and the hood of my jacket pulled low, I could blend in with pedestrian traffic pretty well. Boston was full of college kids. Some of them were even more scraggly and younger looking than me. I turned to Blitz. Where'd you see these people with the flyers?
Beacon Street. They're coming this way. Middle-aged white guy and a teenage girl, probably his daughter.
I frowned. That makes no sense. Who?
I don't know, kid, but I gotta go.
Blitz squinted at the sunrise, which was turning the skyscraper windows orange. For reasons I'd never quite understood, Blitz hated the daylight. Maybe he was the world's shortest, stoutest homeless vampire.
You should go see Hearth. He's hanging out in Copley Square.
I tried not to feel irritated. The local street people jokingly called Hearth and Blitz my mom and dad because one or the other always seemed to be hovering around me. I appreciate it, I said. I'll be fine. Blitz chewed his thumbnail.
I don't know, kid. Not today. You gotta be extra careful.
Why? He glanced over my shoulder.
They're coming.
I didn't see anybody. When I turned back, Blitz was gone. I hated it when he did that. Just poof. The guy was like a ninja. A homeless vampire ninja. Now I had a choice. Go to Copley Square and hang out with Hearth, or head toward Beacon Street and try to spot the people who were looking for me. Blitz's description of them made me curious. A middle-aged white guy and a teenage girl searching for me at sunrise on a bitter cold morning. Why? Who were they? I crept along the edge of the pond. Almost nobody took the lower trail under the bridge. I could hug the side of the hill and spot anyone approaching on the higher path without them seeing me. Snow coated the ground. The sky was eye-achingly blue. The bare tree branches looked like they'd been dipped in glass. The wind cut through my layers of clothes, but I didn't mind the cold. My mom used to joke that I was half polar bear. "Damn it, Magnus," I chided myself. After 2 years, my memories of her were still a minefield. I stumbled over one, and instantly my composure was blown to bits. I tried to focus. The man and the girl were coming this way. The man's sandy hair grew over his collar. Not like an intentional style, but like he couldn't be bothered to cut it. His baffled expression reminded me of a substitute teacher's. "I know I was hit by a spitwad, but I have no idea where it came from." His dress shoes were totally wrong for a Boston winter. His socks were different shades of brown. His tie looked like it had been tied while he spun around in total darkness. The girl was definitely his daughter. Her hair was just as thick and wavy, though lighter blonde. She was dressed more sensibly in snow boots, jeans, and a parka, with an orange t-shirt peeking out at the neckline. Her expression was more determined, angry. She gripped a sheaf of flyers like they were essays she'd been graded on unfairly. If she was looking for me, I did not want to be found. She was scary. I didn't recognize her or her dad, but something tugged at the back of my skull, like a magnet trying to pull out a very old memory. Father and daughter stopped where the path forked. They looked around as if just now realizing they were standing in the middle of a deserted park at no thank you o'clock in the dead of winter. "Unbelievable," said the girl. "I want to strangle him."
That was The Sword of Summer by Rick Riordan. A criminal mastermind creates violent tableaus in an abandoned Detroit warehouse. Oh, the horror! In Broken Monsters, Lauren Bucus's new genre-bending novel of suspense. Detective Gabriella Versado has seen a lot of bodies, but this one is unique, even by Detroit standards. Half boy, half deer, somehow fused together. As stranger and more disturbing bodies are discovered, how can the city hold on to a reality that is already tearing at its seams? If you're Detective Versado's geeky teenage daughter, Layla, you commence a dangerous flirtation with a potential predator online. If you're desperate freelance journalist, Jono, you do whatever it takes to get the exclusive. If you're Thomas Keane, you'll do what you can to keep your homeless family safe and find the monster possessed by the dream of violently remaking the world. An ensemble cast performs the book that the Chicago Sun-Times called one of the scariest and best-written thrillers of the year.
The window of Rocket Coffee gives Jono the perfect view of the hollow shell of Michigan Central Station, the Acropolis of Detroit. Some genius suggested preserving the iconic ruins. That's what everyone's here for, anyway. To gawp at the broken buildings, take their portraits. The only difference between the hipsters breaking into the abandoned buildings here and the middle-aged tourists in socks and sandals in the Colosseum is that the former use more filters on their photographs and the latter have audio guides. Not a bad idea, actually. He could do that. Write audio tours. The problem, he thinks, is not the obsession with ruin porn. It's that everyone is trying to figure out what it all means. It's the human condition, obsessively reading too much into things. Like the fact that she is 46 minutes late. And that's 31 minutes longer than you should be expected to wait for any girl. Unless she's a certified supermodel, or the producer on the biopic of your awesome life, according to 10 rules for the new Gentleman's Guide to Dating he churned out for some shitty men's site last year. It's all bait to pull in the likes. But eyeballs are more fickle than sharks, and the economy is still in the gutter, and he should be writing a post-postmodern Moby Dick, not trying to come up with smarmy listicles faster than everyone else. But try getting paid for that. Oh, he's been published in obscure literary magazines with a subscriber base of 8, not including the publisher's mother or the complimentary contributor copies. All the wannabe writers desperately reading each other's stories, as if they could generate enough energy in a magnetic feedback loop that it would draw some of those eyeballs over here. But it's all. Even his stuff. It's only because he has realized that she's not coming that he can even consider this. Because this is such a disaster, it mitigates his total failure as a writer. She's not coming. The despair cuts through the caffeine poisoning. He's already had 3 cups of coffee, at first because he felt smug, sitting in the window bar, waiting for the hot DJ girl. That was before the great wake-up call, and then he lost his place when he went back for the 3rd flat white, and now he is wedged in the back, near the bathroom, perched at a little round table that seems specifically designed to be emasculating. But she was beaming at you, apparently. The beaming. This depressing ghost town of a city. F*** his career. He should write a meltdown memoir, an anthem for his generation. Bret Easton Ellis with more man-child ennui. Then she walks in the door, and he swears to God that all the atoms in the room recompose themselves around her. She's wearing jeans and snow boots and a puffy jacket in an electric turquoise that matches her eyeshadow, with jangly earrings and her braids tied up in an elaborate croissant twist. "Hi," she says, slinging her bag down onto the table, recklessly enough that he has to grab for his cup. "Sorry." "You say that a lot." He's grinning. He can't help it. "Yes, well," she shrugs. "What, you didn't get me one?" "Half an hour ago." "You want another?" She indicates his cup, still 3/4 full, and he finds himself nodding, even though a 4th will probably tip him into heart attack territory, like that kid who died from chugging energy drinks. But coffee is natural. So is herpes. "But to go, okay?"
"What about breakfast?"
"We'll get pastries. I want you to show me around town. Show me your Detroit."
"What does that mean?"
"Whatever you want it to. Personal perspectives on the city."
"All right,"
she says, with the same tolerantly amused look she had when he walked in on her with her hand between her legs. Definitely love, he thinks.
That was Broken Monsters by Lauren Bucus. The String Diaries opens as Hannah frantically drives through the night, her daughter asleep in the back, her husband bleeding out in the front seat. In the trunk of the car rests a cache of diaries dating back 200 years, tied and retied with strings through the generations. The diaries carry the rules for survival that have been handed down from mother to daughter since the 19th century. But how can Hannah escape an enemy with the ability to look and sound like the people she loves? Stephen Lloyd Jones's debut is a sweeping thriller that extends from the present day to Oxford in the 1970s, then to Hungary at the turn of the 19th century. If Hannah fails to end the chase now, her daughter is next in line. Hannah must be willing to sacrifice everything to put a centuries-old curse to rest. Gemma Whelan performs the book.
She heard him shift his weight in the seat and try to conceal a gasp of pain. Immediately she wrenched the binoculars from her face. "Nate, what is it? What can I do?" "Nothing, Anne, I'm fine." His voice was husky with exhaustion. "Go on, check the house." She raised the glasses back to her eyes, trained them on the farmhouse this time. Its whitewashed stone walls glowed with the reflection of a nebulous moon. She found the outline of what she knew from photographs was a sagging slate roof. "What am I looking for?" "Check the windows first. Are they intact?" A pause while she checked all 4. "Yes, the ones that I can see. That's good. What about the door? Is it open? Does it look like it's been forced?" "It's difficult to tell, but..." She frowned. "No, I think it's secure." "That's good, Han. That's great. Okay. Look, I don't think anyone is here. I don't think anyone can be, but we're going to be cautious all the same. We're going to keep the lights out until we're off the main road, and we're going to drive slowly. The entrance is just up ahead. From what I remember of this place, it's rough going until we get down to that bridge, then it flattens out. We'll park around the far side of the house so that nobody can see our car from the road. He paused, hissing through his teeth as he shifted his weight again. Are you ready? Hannah blew air from her cheeks, nodded. Take the binoculars for me. She held them out to him, felt his hand brush against hers. His fingers were wet, sticky. She felt her throat constricting. Nate, are you still bleeding? It doesn't matter, come on. We're nearly safe now. She suddenly had to know. Despite his calming words, his encouragement, she was still reeling from the shock of tonight's events. Before they went any further, she needed to know exactly what she faced. On impulse, her hand went to the overhead light. She snapped it on. Some of the hope Hannah had been clinging to died then, as she saw the true state of him. She clenched her teeth and forced her jaw to still itself, determined not to reveal how acutely his appearance affected her. Blood drenched him. His woolen jacket was saturated with it. The fabric of his shirt glistened and dripped. Blood pooled between his legs. It collected in the folds of the seat. It soaked his jeans. When Hannah raised her eyes to his face, her emotions betrayed her and she sobbed. He was dying. She could have no doubt. Scarcely any life could remain inside him. His lips had lost all of their colour. His cheeks, where he had not wiped blood over them, were as pale as milk. Despite the cool air inside the 4x4, sweat stood out in beads upon his skin. Nate tried to smile, but when his lips drew back from his teeth, she saw a corpse leering at her. I think the bleeding is starting to slow down. Her voice trembled, on the verge of a scream. We need to get you to a hospital, Nate, right now. He shook his head. No, we can't. It'll be all right. I promise you. Nate, we... No. Hannah, listen to me. Nate paused, and she saw he was gulping for air. We can't take any risks with this. You know that. I know you do. What happens to me is irrelevant. We have to protect Leah. The scream pressed at the back of Hannah's throat, taunting her. At the mention of Leah's name, she turned to look at their daughter, asleep on the back seat. The sight of her smooth face, so fragile and so serene, terrified her and rallied her in equal measure. He was right. They had no choice. But how did she meet Nate's eyes and accept his words without protest? How could she become an accessory to sacrifice like that? It tore something within her. Only two people in the world she loved like this. Putting one before the other was unthinkable, as was the alternative. Nate eased his hand out of his jacket, stared at his bloodied fingers. This is survivable, Han, believe me.
That was The String Diaries by Stephen Lloyd-Jones. With his marriage on the rocks and life in shambles, washed-up true crime writer Lucas Graham is desperate for a comeback. His chance comes when he's promised exclusive access to a death row inmate, Jeffrey Halcombe, the notorious cult leader and mass murderer who's ready to break his silence after 30 years. In Anya Allborn's Within These Walls, Lucas leaves New York to live in and work from the scene of the crime, a split-level farmhouse on a gray-sanded beach in Washington State. The house's foundation is steeped in the blood of Halcombe's runaways who were drawn to his message of family, unity, and unconditional love. As Lucas sets out to capture the real story of the departed faithful, he finds he's not alone. Jeffrey Halcombe had promised his followers eternal life, and Lucas soon finds out that within these walls, the cult clan is far from dead. R.C. Bray performs the book.
Audra had never been the outdoorsy type. Even as a child, growing up in Seattle, she preferred to stay in her room than to play out on the preened back lawn or explore the rivers and trees of the Cascade Range. In her mind, people who enjoyed being out in nature were at peace with feeling small. But for her, being swallowed up by the Washington forests was a terrifying prospect. Standing on the shore only to stare out at an endless expanse of ocean made her feel even smaller than she already imagined herself to be. The only peace she found in the water or trees was the lingering thought that Mother Nature could take her if only Audra allowed it. The forest would bury her if she lay down for long enough. The ocean would pull her under if she didn't fight the current, if she breathed in the water the way she so effortlessly did the air. And yet late that morning, she found herself pacing the length of the kitchen, back and forth across the linoleum. Her gaze occasionally flicked up to the window above the sink, casting a glance onto the overgrown cherry orchard just beyond the glass. It had been 2 days since she and Maggie had taken their walk on the beach, 48 hours since she had met the charismatic mystery man who had made her feel a little less invisible than usual. Now the beach was calling her back. She needed to see the ocean, the sand, those tents. Back and forth she went, from refrigerator to the stove. Shadow watched her from the mouth of the kitchen, his tail giving her a hopeful wag every time their eyes met.
"You know you want to," he panted. "It isn't raining. We could go check. Just give a peek down the coastline, see if they're still there."
Audra paused her pacing, her gaze fixed on her dog's furry face.
"What is it?" she asked him. "You want to go out?"
Shadow sucked his bobbing tongue into his mouth. His ears perked at the suggestion, but he didn't move from where he sat.
"You want to go to the beach?"
He stood up, his tail flicking left and right.
"You want to go see if Deacon is still there?"
Shadow snorted, excited by a prospect Audra knew he didn't understand. He bowed into a quite literal downward dog, his butt held high in the air.
"But it'll be weird if we just show up," she murmured, lifting a hand to chew on a nail. "Maybe I should call Maggie."
Shadow barked.
"Forget Maggie."
She raised an eyebrow at his insistence.
"What do you need Maggie for? You've got me."
"You're right."
She let her arms drop to her sides.
"I live here, and you want to go for a walk, don't you?"
As soon as she uttered Shadow's trigger word, walk, his eyes went wild. He reared up and bolted out of the kitchen, completed a couple of breakneck donuts around the coffee table, and returned to his spot with unbridled anticipation. Audra cracked a smile at his enthusiasm. There really was no choice now. If she backed out, she'd break Shadow's thumping doggy heart. She saw the tents as soon as she and Shadow made their way out of the thicket of trees and into the clearing that opened onto the coast. At first, she thought she was imagining things, but the charred remains of their bonfire assured her that the tents had moved from where they'd been on Thursday afternoon. They were closer now, as if inching their way toward her home. Shadow made a run for the tents. When he nudged his snout inside one of them, she sucked in a breath to yell for him to come back. Before she could find her voice, Deacon's head popped out of the flap. He clambered out and then strolled toward her with a wide smile across his face.
"Audra!"
He caught her in a tight hug as soon as he was able to reach her.
"We were wondering when we'd see you again."
"You were?" The question was poised on her tongue, but she held it back.
"Come,"
he said, motioning for her to follow him despite not giving her much choice. Without asking whether she'd like to join him, he looped his arm through hers and pulled her along. By the time they reached the new campsite, the girls, who had fussed over Shadow on Audra's previous visit, had crawled out of Deacon's tent.
We've just heard Within These Walls by Anya Allborn. A Love Like Blood is the first novel for adults by acclaimed YA writer Marcus Sedgwick. It's a gripping saga of love, revenge, obsession, and vampires. In 1944, just days after the liberation of Paris, Charles Jackson sees something horrific. A man in a dark tunnel, apparently drinking the blood of a murdered woman. Terrified, he does nothing, telling himself that this is another tragedy of war. 7 years later, he returns to the city and sees the same man dining in the company of a fascinating, beautiful young woman. When they leave the restaurant, Charles decides to follow. Sean Grindel performs this dark, compelling thriller about how a man's life can change in a moment.
Hunter Wilson had been at school with my father, and they had gone up to Cambridge at the same time. Hunter had eventually become a professor in the Faculty of English at Sydney, Sussex, while my father had gone into property to make a fortune. Although he wasn't actually family, trips to visit Hunter when I was a boy had made him feel like an uncle to me, all the more so as I had no real uncles, my mother and father both being only children. Through my time as an undergraduate, Hunter was a regular part of my life, and I think we both enjoyed the way that the gap in our ages didn't seem to exist, let alone to matter. Hunter had brought me many things in life already, by that tender age. It was he who gave me a love of music and of reading, and now, in an indirect way, he gave me Marion. "So," she said, "let's have some answers. Who are you, and why are you following me?" I was at first thrown by such directness, though I came to like it very soon. It made it so much easier to know what your companion was thinking and feeling, instead of footling around with English correctness. "My name is Charles Jackson," I said, "and I'm a hematologist." I hesitated for a moment, because I was used to people asking a what whenever I told them what I did. Marion didn't, and waited for me to go on. "I'm here for a conference on leukemia. It's something we're working on in Cambridge just now." "You live in Cambridge?" I nodded. I thought I might be managing to steer her away from her other question, but I was wrong. "And you're following me because..." I did something foolish. I contradicted what I'd already admitted. "No," I said, "I'm not following you, I..." She stood immediately, making to leave. "You were in Saint-Germain earlier. I saw you at lunch, and on the train. I thought you weren't going to lie to me. So, I'll wish you good evening." "No," I said, perhaps a touch too forcefully. I softened my voice. "No, wait, I'm sorry, I only meant... I wasn't really following you, not to start with, at least. It's your friend." She stood, waiting, but did not sit down again. "Anton?" I now had a name. I had to assume it was my quarry's. I nodded. "Why?" "I'll explain. Won't you sit down, please?" She sat. The bar was filling up steadily with locals, mostly single working men stopping for a glass of Pernod on the way home. Night had come on, and the rain was a drizzle once more, snaking softly down the window glass. I said I would explain, and yet I never did. Not really. What could I tell her? Not the truth. That I thought he was a murderer at worst, or some demented pervert at best. I saw how stupid that would look, and I didn't want to lose the chance to use this connection I'd found to the man. I might be able to find out more about him if I didn't give her cause to be cautious. Besides that, I realized I already didn't want this conversation with Marion to end quickly. I found I wanted to say something that would make her stay a while longer, and her cognac glass was already empty. I downed mine and held it up. "Another?" She paused for a moment, then turned and waved at the barman, who wandered over and refilled both our glasses.
We've just heard A Love Like Blood by Marcus Sedgwick. Consumed is the debut novel by iconic filmmaker David Cronenberg. It is the story of two journalists whose entanglement in a French philosopher's death becomes a surreal journey into global conspiracy. William Hurt performs the book, making it a top choice for Halloween listening. Stylish and camera-obsessed, Naomi and Nathan thrive on yellow journalism of the social media age. They are lovers and competitors, nomadic freelancers in pursuit of sensation and depravity. Naomi finds herself drawn to the headlines surrounding Celestine and Aristide, Marxist philosophers and sexual libertines. Celestine has been found dead and mutilated in her Paris apartment. Aristide has disappeared. Police suspect him of killing her and consuming parts of her body. Nathan, meanwhile, is in Budapest photographing the controversial work of an unlicensed surgeon once sought by Interpol for organ trafficking. Cronenberg constructs two parallel narratives that become entwined in a dreamlike plot that involves geopolitics, North Korea, the Cannes Film Festival, and in an incredible number of varieties, sex.
The dead woman intimidated Naomi. Celestine turned languidly toward Aristide. Smoke tumbled from her mouth and nose and drifted over to him like the passing of an evanescent baton. He took a breath to speak, inhaling the smoke, continuing her thought. Even if you never get it, or once having it, never use it, as long as you desire it. You can see this in the youngest babies. Their desire is fierce. As he spoke these words, he began to stroke his tie, which was tucked into an elegant V-necked cashmere sweater. It was as though he were petting one of those fierce babies, and the gestures seemed to explain the blissful smile that suffused his face. Celestine watched him for a moment, waited for the petting to stop before she turned back to the unseen interviewer. That's why we say that the only authentic literature of the modern era is the owner's manual. Stretching forward toward the lens, revealing voluptuously freckled cleavage, Celestine fumbled for something off camera, then slumped back, with a small, thick, white booklet in her cigarette hand. She riffled through the pages, her face myopically close to the print, or was she smelling the paper, the ink, until she found her page and began to read. Auto flash without red eye reduction. Set this mode for taking pictures without people, or if you want to shoot right away without the red eye function. She laughed, that rich, husky laugh, and repeated, this time with great drama, set this mode for taking pictures without people. A shake of the head, eyes now closed to fully feel the richness of the words. What author of the past century has produced more provocative and poignant writing than that? The window containing the Aristides shrank back to thumbnail size and became the lower left corner of a newscast window. The now tiny Aristides were still very relaxed and chatty, each picking up the conversation from the other like experienced handball players. But Naomi no longer heard what they said. Instead, it was the words of the overly earnest newscaster in the primary window that she heard. It was in this very apartment of Celestine and Aristide Rostegui, an apartment near the famous Sorbonne of the University of Paris, that the grisly, butchered remains of a woman were found. A woman later identified as Celestine Arostegui. In the small window, the camera zoomed in on the amiably chatting Aristide. Her husband, the renowned French philosopher and author Aristide Arostegui, could not be found for questioning. In one brutal cut, Aristide disappeared, to be replaced by handheld, starkly frontlit shots of the tiny apartment's kitchen, apparently taken at night. These soon swelled to full size, and the newscaster's window retreated to the upper right corner. Forensic police, wearing black surgical gloves, were taking frosted plastic bags out of a fridge, photographing grimy pots and frying pans on the stove, sorting through dishes and cutlery. The miniature newscaster continued, "Sources wishing to remain unnamed have told us that there is evidence to suggest that parts of Celestine Arostegui's body were cooked on her own stove and eaten."
That was Consumed by David Cronenberg. Readers, thanks so much for joining us in this chilling literary tribute to Halloween. For more titles guaranteed to scare you senseless, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Enjoy Halloween, the candy, the costumes, the horror. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.